this episode of the Fisheries Podcast, I talk with Emily Schlesinger, a PhD student at Rutgers University, working on black sea bass and how they are affected by climate change. Thank you for joining me. I am Nick Kramer, and this is the Fisheries Podcast, a weekly podcast that shares the stories of the amazing people and projects that make up fisheries science. If you haven't already, follow the podcast on Twitter, at FisheriesPod, or on Facebook at facebook.com/fisheriespodcast. I recently put out a request for guests on Twitter, and have been amazed at all the people willing to be a guest. The first of those to schedule time is our guest today, Emily Schlesinger. Emily grew up in San Diego, California, along the sunny California coast. She attended the University of California, Santa Cruz for her undergraduate degree, where she initially was an environmental studies major, but quickly added marine biology as a double major. It was during her time at the University of California, Santa Cruz that she realized she was both intrigued by fish as a marine organism, but also that her happiest research moments were when she was on the water. So studying fisheries science in graduate school seemed like the correct fit. Emily began looking for a graduate school program that fit her research interest, and she found the perfect fit at Rutgers University, studying under Dr. Grace Saba, looking at black sea bass physiology as it relates to climate change. Welcome to the podcast, Emily.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So you mentioned in the longer bio that you sent me in your email that you once took a tugboat trip from Seattle to Alaska. I guess, was this the first instance that you can remember where you realized that you loved the ocean?
Yeah, it definitely was. My uncle was a tugboat captain. He would do trips from Seattle to Alaska, and their route would take them along the southeastern portion of Alaska, so through Ketchikan, Skagway, and Juneau. So when I was 8, I was invited to go with my dad on one of these trips. And for the most part, we hugged the Northwest Passage, and it was relatively calm. Saw lots of orcas and whales and birds, and it was since we hit the open ocean that I was both exhilarated by waves but also realized that I am human and I get seasick. So after we realized that, medicated myself, the rest of the trip was a blast, and I think it was in that moment that I realized I also really like being out on the water.
So that passion that was instilled on that trip led you to the California Santa Cruz, where you were a double major and fairly busy with extracurriculars, you know, one of which was volunteering on a series of the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration cruises. How many of these did you get to go out on, and what all did you get to experience on those trips?
So I went out on 3 while I was in Santa Cruz. And funny story, so initially when I started my marine biology degree, I was kind of hungry for any opportunity I could get working in a lab. And I started off in a krill ecology lab. And one of the ways that they get their samples for their annual counts of krill in the Monterey Bay region is by collecting them on these NOAA research cruises. So my first time on a fisheries cruise, my actual job was to collect krill, but I was able to help out with a lot of the fish sorting. I think it was on those cruises where I started realizing that maybe more of my passion lied with fisheries. And so when I graduated in 2015, I actually ended up volunteering with the Santa Cruz NOAA group. And I went on the cruise again, but this time I helped them fully with their fisheries work.
Before you graduated, you were also able to take advantage of a 3-month study abroad trip to Australia. How is the schooling and field experiences different across the Pacific Ocean than what you had experienced at California Santa Cruz?
Well, for one, the ocean was very, very warm. that was very pleasant. We were stationed in Queensland, specifically in Brisbane, but all of our marine biology research were located somewhere in the Great Barrier Reef. So the first trip we were on Stradbroke Island in the southern Great Barrier Reef, which is gorgeous but quite degraded nowadays. And the second trip was on Heron Island, which is in the outer Great Barrier Reef. And that area was pristine. So there in Australia, I was able to do some studies first on tide pool fishes. So one of the big differences in in Australia, in the region that I was in, was that the tidal fluctuations were huge. So there were large swaths of sandy beach when we got to this field station. And one of the researchers that worked there told us that by the time that it was high tide, the entire sandy area was going to be covered fully with water. So we set up a research experiment because in these big tidal regimes, you get soft tide pools that form naturally. So we were curious about the fish assemblages that arise when you've got fish, small fish, seeking out these small soft tidal pools as a way to escape predation. So we would go out and dig our own soft tide pools and mark them. And then we would come out at every single low tide to count the fish that we caught in all of our pools. And that was also probably the first time that I was living my life according to the ocean's tides. So we were waking up at, 3 a.m. and then going back to bed and then coming back out at 3 p.m. experience.
And as if that wasn't enough to set you apart from other undergraduate students, you then partook in a competitive summer research program clear across the U.S. at the University of Rhode Island. What kind of things were you looking at that summer?
So that summer, I was actually working on a project looking at a tea spore out there, Nemiopsis ladyi, who's native to the Narragansett Bay region, but whose abundance has been increasing over the past few decades. And a lot of people think that's related to climate change and ocean warming. But in my true undergrad fashion, I found my way into a zooplankton lab about fisheries work. So during most of the week, I was working on my small summer project. I found that the University of Rhode Island also had a fish trawling sampling that they did every week in Narragansett Bay. And so I would go on those trawling trips and help characterize and sort their catch. It was a really cool experience for me because at that point, all I really knew were the marine organisms that I'd seen in California, along the California current system. Helping out on these fisheries trawls in Narragansett Bay was the first time that I was becoming well-versed with fish and invertebrate species on the East Coast. For most of my life, my schooling had led me to become very comfortable and knowledgeable about the species we find out in California. And it was fun to be able to make contrast between the different types of species that we see between our two different coasts. So this also kept me very intrigued about essentially this whole other ocean, part of the United States that I had been ignoring from pretty much my whole life.
All of that great experience surely made you an exceptional candidate for graduate school. And as we mentioned in the bio, you believe you found a perfect fit for your research interest at Rutgers University. I'm a Midwestern kid and never fished in the ocean. And your project deals with black sea bass. I grew up fishing largemouth bass. So why don't you explain to someone like myself who has never seen or handled or really heard too much about a black sea bass?
So black sea bass are, in my opinion, an incredible species. There are three different stocks in the United States. There's a stock in the Gulf of Mexico, stock in the southeastern United States from Cape Hatteras all the way down to Florida, and then a northeastern stock found from Cape Hatteras all the way up to now the Gulf of Maine. So I'm studying the northeastern stock of black sea bass. These are centropids, so they're in a tropical reef fish family. And with that comes the same sort of social reef structure systems. So black sea bass are protogynous hermaphrodites, which means that some of the females will transition to male at some point in their life. And during the spawning season, you'll have males guarding either a reef or an artificial reef. And he's protecting a harem of females throughout the spawning season. And so the males get this really beautiful, deep blue and cerulean coloration on their forehead and near the dorsal spines and around their cheeks. And some of the big dominant males will also develop a large nuchal hump, which will continue to grow throughout their entire life. So these fish also migrate inshore offshore. So they'll spend the winter months offshore near the continental shelf break. Reason being is that while this temperature still gets pretty cold in the winter, it's more stable than if they were to stay inshore. And then as the ocean warms up, black sea bass will migrate inshore and they'll kind of distribute themselves throughout the intercontinental shelf and this part, they get pretty close inshore, just about a mile or two offshore. These make them a very popular species for recreational fishing, but there's also a very large commercial fishery for black sea bass as well.
You recently had a manuscript published on your first dissertation chapter dealing with how temperature affects their aerobic scope. And I guess, again, before diving in too far, can you first explain aerobic scope before discussing how that might affect your black sea bass?
Definitely. So aerobic scope is the difference between an organism's maximum and standard metabolic rate. So your standard metabolic rate is the baseline maintenance level of metabolism. So essentially, you could view this as if you were lying down on your bed. You weren't quite sleeping, but you weren't moving. You were fully digested and just fully relaxed. The maximum metabolic rate is the fastest that the metabolism can go aerobically, so with oxygen. So this can be viewed as almost a near sprint. And the idea here is that the difference between the two is available aerobic scope, which is the amount of metabolism available to an organism beyond which it needs for maintenance. And because fish are ectotherms, their metabolic rate will increase with increasing temperatures. And so we look for the change in aerobic scope across a range of temperatures. And the idea here is that where aerobic scope is highest, the temperature it tracks to should be its thermal optimum. But as we were going through the study and also in the recent literature, this concept of aerobic scope being the highest at a certain temperature, giving a thermal optimal temperature, is starting to be proven not quite a robust concept anymore.
So I guess, how do you get the aerobic scope of these different black sea bass? Is there something you're doing in the field, or do you bring them back to a lab and run them through a indoor raceway?
Yeah, so we do all these experiments in the lab. We've got essentially intermittent respirometry to measure our aerobic scope. And we actually, for this study, we compared two different methods to obtain maximum metabolic rate. In the literature, it's debatable which method is better, and it's definitely very species specific. And we were also lucky enough to have a swim form of us to test black sea bass maximum metabolic rate performance. So the first maximum metabolic rate method we used was the chase method. And essentially, we place a fish in a chase tank and we chase the fish. We use this with a series of light tail pinches. And we do this until the fish is exhausted. And we determine that by being able to pick up out of the water and have it rest in our hands without any signs of distress or movement. Then we immediately put our fish in our respirometers. These respirometers are these small plastic chambers that we place into an external water bath. They have two pumps attached to them. One is a flush pump that will bring water from the external water bath into the chamber. And the other pump is a recirculator that circulates water from the chamber, around the chamber and back into the chamber. So it's essentially a closed loop. And the line is really important because it helps mix the water within the respirometer, the area where we place our oxygen optode, to give us real-time measurements of the oxygen saturation in the water. And this is important because when we use intermittent respirometry, we essentially will shut off the flush pump to the respirometer, and it effectively closes the chamber. We measure the rate of oxygen decline, and that rate of oxygen decline is the fish using up the oxygen in the chamber. And then after a predetermined time, the flush pump turns back on, and we flush the chamber with new, fresh, oxygenated water. And we repeat that system, or we repeat that series for 24 hours. Intermittent respirometry allows us to get multiple great measurements over a long extended period of time. It also allows us to go home and sleep and shower, which is nice. When we put the fish in right after the chase, we're picking up their maximum post-chase. Remains in the chamber and is undisturbed over about 24 hours, picking up its standard metabolic rate. Again, that baseline level of metabolism to survive. Another maximum metabolic rate method using a swim flume, a fish treadmill. They put a fish in this chamber and motor generates a current, and the fish starts to swim against that current. And we can increase the speed of that current to initiate faster and faster swimming in the fish. And to be comparable to the chase method, we employed a sprint protocol in the swim flume where we had we tried to replicate the same sort of burst swimming that they were doing in the chase.
So then after you gather all your results and get all your metabolic rates in the aerobic scopes, how do you use that information to help the management, or how does that information help you learn how climate change might affect these individual fish?
First, we tested black sea bass at a range of temperatures. We tested them from 12 degrees Celsius, which is about 54 degrees Fahrenheit, all the way up to 30 degrees Celsius, which is about 86 degrees Fahrenheit. Now, most black sea bass you won't find in 86 degrees, but under certain climate change projection scenarios with ocean warming projections, parts of the mid-Atlantic Bight where black sea bass are distributed could reach that temperature in about 80 years. So we wanted to test some warm temperatures that were indicative of future temperatures. And we also, to further test this idea of how do black sea bass do at these very warm temperatures under certain climate change scenarios, we also held a subset of black sea bass at 30 degrees Celsius for an entire month. Here we were looking at acclimation potential. And what we found is that black sea bass were not able to acclimate to 30 degrees Celsius over a long extended period of time. We had some mortalities during the month holding them at 30 degrees Celsius, and their aerobic scope also dropped significantly at that high temperature. And the idea here is that we can use this relationship of the organism's metabolism to temperature and then try to incorporate physiology in these large modeling exercises that look at fish distribution based off of temperature. So on the East Coast, a lot of the modeling we do of fish related to bottom temperature or sea surface temperature are typically based off of annual trawl surveys that we have, either run by the federal government, so through NOAA, or there are some state-run programs as well. And the problem with this is the relationship of a fish to a given temperature is solely based on presence, absence, did you find them in that temperature during that collection or not. So our hopes are if we can start peering in some of this physiological data, that we'll get a better indication of which temperatures are preferable for black sea bass. And then we can model different climate change scenarios with either a doubling of CO2 or different CO2 increase scenarios, how we might expect to see black sea bass distribution shift in the future. So if you're interested in reading more about this study, we also threw in some hypoxic tolerance studies looking at how temperature affects black sea bass under low oxygen scenarios. So if you're interested in reading more, this paper actually just came out today. The title of the paper is The Effects of Ocean Warming on Black Sea Bass, Aerobic Scope and Hypoxia Tolerance, and it's through PLOS One.
And you're also looking at another aspect of how temperature affects these black sea bass, but this time you're also looking at the migration distance and how that might affect it. I guess without me fumbling over more of it in the asking the question, why don't you take away on and explain that one?
In the laboratory study that we just finished, I was really intrigued about two different things. The first was that I've been reading a lot of papers looking at this relationship of temperature to metabolism, and then finding in the lab that we're not finding things that we are expecting. So in my example, the thermal optimum that we found according to this aerobic scope idea is actually much warmer than we would have expected black sea bass to be at. So we found a thermal optimum about 24.4 degrees Celsius, which is about 76 degrees Fahrenheit, which is really pretty warm for this fish. They're fine in that temperature, but we don't think that they're actively seeking that warm of the temperature. And so I was interested in basically trying to take some of these concepts that we're learning in the lab and applying it to the field. And because black sea bass in the Northeast have a very large range, so again, from Cape Hatteras all the way up to the Gulf of Maine, that means that when they come inshore during the spawning season, that those fish are going to be experiencing a wide variety of bottom temperatures simply related to their latitudinal distribution. And the other important component of the story is that when black sea bass migrate offshore for the winter months, they don't just migrate to the continental shelf, but those that are found in the north will actually migrate to the continental shelf edge and then south, so that you get a very large number of sea bass down off of the continental shelf and directly east of, say, Virginia Beach and Maryland area. So that means that the fish in Virginia don't really need to migrate a whole lot. The fish from Massachusetts are going to migrate a very large distance before they start spawning. The last important piece of information and background is that black sea bass do exhibit some site fidelity. So the fish that were found in Massachusetts for one summer likely will return to the north the following summer, although that rule doesn't necessarily stand 100% of the time. So I was interested in these components of temperature throughout their range, especially during the spawning season. These fish are going to experience their highest energetic requirements throughout a given year. And then also how the distance that they had to migrate before spawning is going to affect them. I've been collecting black sea bass throughout the spawning season, so pre, during, and post-spawning. And I've been collecting black sea bass from Massachusetts, New Jersey, Delaware, and now Virginia. I'm collecting black sea bass through a variety of methods. I'm relying on some help from state agencies and universities that have trap-run surveys. So this has been the case for Delaware, New Jersey, and Massachusetts. But I've been going out on recreational fishing boats, and I'm fishing for black sea bass to collect my specimens. And this has been probably one of the most rewarding aspects of this project, is that I've been able to become really well integrated in the fishing communities found throughout the Northeast, all the way from Massachusetts down to Virginia. And once I collect the fish, I bring them back to the lab and I dissect them. So I get a length, a weight, and then I remove some muscle tissue, I remove the liver, and I remove the gonads. And I'm basically looking at how energy changes throughout the spawning season, throughout these three sort of energy depots in a fish, because liver energy is tightly linked to gonad energy throughout the spawning season. And I'm also trying to look at some aspects of fecundity. So I'm looking at gonadosomatic index, gonad weight divided by body weight. And I'm also going to look at some batch fecundity counts to get an idea of potential as one proxy for before full fecundity. And I'm looking at these different aspects of energy and fecundity, and I'm seeing how they're different throughout black sea bass range. So I'm comparing between these four regions. So this summer, I'm in my second year of collections. I'm getting fish from Delaware and Virginia this summer. And I've been starting to work up a lot of the data that I received last summer, which was, again, New Jersey and Massachusetts collections. And I'm actually finding that a lot of my hypotheses that I've posed are all being slapped down, which is both exciting and also leaving me scratching my head a little. So initially what I'd expected to see was that because black sea bass are moving north, and we're seeing this both in anecdotal evidence from fishermen, but also in a lot of these large modeling exercises, they're all pointing to black sea bass expanding northward. So under these principles, I thought that, well, the northern region for black sea bass should be the most favorable energetically, and then potentially for fecundity. And actually what I'm starting to find is that the Massachusetts fish start off spawning in some worse condition, likely due to that large migration they had to undergo. And that instead of having high reproductive output, that they're actually having less high reproductive output than I'm seeing in New Jersey and even starting to see down in Virginia. And then further to add to the confusion is that this nice temperature gradient I had envisioned from Virginia to Massachusetts, where Virginia, you know, should be the warmest, and you go up to Massachusetts and that should be the coldest, is that where I'm collecting these fish and where the fish are choosing to be, I'm actually starting to see a reverse temperature gradient. So Massachusetts fish were found mostly in Buzzard Bay, and that area can warm up quite quickly in the early summer months, likely due to large tidal mixing in that region, and that the fish down in Virginia don't even come inshore anymore. And I go fishing trips, not even fishing for black sea bass. I go on tail fishing trips. I'm collecting my black sea bass offshore. And if you ask any fisherman, well, could I try to get some black sea bass inshore? The answer is no, that there's just none left inshore. But that means that those fish in Virginia are actually in pretty deep water. And so far, Virginia has been my coldest sampling region. So got a lot of thinking to do, but it's still been a really exciting project.
And you're also collaborating with some others on different projects involving black sea bass. And one of them is looking into an interesting reproductive strategy that some fish exhibit, sneaker males versus dominant males. And you're using some sex hormones, namely androgens, to try to distinguish between these two different male reproductive strategies. What can you tell us about that project?
As I mentioned before, black sea bass are part of a tropical reef fish family. And so we see a lot of these harem dynamics where you have dominant male protecting a harem of females. And he typically is territorial over a large or small home range. And in this system, you start seeing sneaker males that mimic the coloration and the size of females. And then during a spawning event, they'll try to sneak in and essentially almost parasitize that spawning event. And we see there's a ton of different types of protogynous hermaphroditic fish species. So this is a typical view that we have of black sea bass. Now, up in Massachusetts, the population density of black sea bass has exploded. And this is due to a large number of factors. And it's likely not one factor that's the main culprit. So again, it could be related to this ocean warming idea that as these oceans are warming, we're seeing more and more black sea bass move north. It could also be related to the fact that black sea bass used to be overfished, and now they're not overfished and overfishing is not occurring. So we're also seeing a rebound in our populations here. And third, we've also recently had some very, very large year classes that have primarily exhibited site fidelity in the northern regions. So all these factors are leading to tons of black sea bass found in Buzzards Bay and Nantucket Shoals area. And it's leading us to believe that essentially this harem dynamic that you typically see with black sea bass is starting to break down, likely due to population density, because it's becoming too disfavorable for these big dominant males to try to defend a harem and a territory when there's tons of other big dominant males in the region. And you can see this especially when you go fishing. So a lot of times you'll go fishing for, and one or two or three people will get some nice large males on these trips. In Massachusetts, when you're fishing in Buzzards Bay, you can have 6-7 people all at once bringing up large, large dominant males. So those males have been hanging out in the same area. And so we're curious to see if that the black sea bass in Massachusetts are actually starting to develop more of a group spawning dynamic where it's just one large spawning event when they start spawning. Look at these differences by sex hormones and, as I said, androgens. So the two androgens that we're looking at are testosterone and 11-ketotestosterone. And 11-ketotestosterone is the primary culprit for things like secondary sexual characteristics, aggression, these sort of things attributed to what we might see as dominance. So in a sort of typical system, you'll expect to see that the dominant males will have very high androgen levels and that the sneaker males will have relatively low androgen levels. But you can see differences in gonadal investment. So those sneaker males will actually have much larger gonad to body size ratios than the dominant males. Now, in a group spawning system, we might not expect to see these large differences between males in the same region. But overall, we might see differences in their androgens between Massachusetts and Virginia. Because in that group spawning system, while there might not be this partitioning of high versus low androgen allotment between the two different types of males, you do just have overall tons of males in the area. And that competition and that aggression can also spike androgen levels. We might see across the board higher androgen levels in Massachusetts. And then these very interesting site-specific differences down in Virginia. So I'm working with the Massachusetts Department of Marine Fisheries and a graduate student out of UMass Boston. And they're going to be doing a lot of the black sea bass blood collection in Massachusetts. And I'm doing blood collection for black sea bass down in Virginia this summer.
And when we first started talking about your work with black sea bass, we talked about how you were studying the metabolic rate of these fish in the laboratory, but you're also collaborating with Dr. Clive Truman at the University of Southampton to look at how you might be able to use otoliths to determine their metabolic rate in the field, or their field metabolic rate and their thermal history. What can you tell us about this project?
Yeah, so I'm really excited about this project. Essentially, what happened is my advisor is heading a fish carbon workshop, an NSF-funded workshop looking at essentially the role of fish poop in carbon cycling. And one of the researchers that's part of this workshop came to Rutgers during their two-day workshop, and he started presenting about his stable isotope work. And he brought up that one of the things that they've been working on is using otoliths to figure out field metabolic rates using stable isotopes. And the reason they're really interested in that is they work on a lot of deep sea or mesopelagic fishes where it's not feasible to bring fish into the lab to run experiments like we do on black sea bass. So they started trying to perfect this technique of looking at the carbon stable isotope in the otolith to derive field metabolic rates. This isn't necessarily a new idea, but they were the first ones to finally do a laboratory study and testing these principles of metabolic rate and how temperature may affect it. But essentially, the Del C13 signature of the fish that's within the bloodstream also is found in the fluid that bathes the otoliths in their sac. And as we know, otoliths can incorporate the chemical structures of that fluid throughout a fish's life. And so we can use otoliths to determine the Del C13 and then thus backtrack to figure out field metabolic rates. But this also means we have to collect muscle tissue samples to determine the contribution of the diet. We also have to figure out the DIC content of the water. And the other cool thing about using this technique is while we're at it, we can also look at the Del-18 or the oxygen isotope, and that can help us backtrack to figure out what temperature the fish was in. Now, although we're using micro drills for this, which give us very, very fine resolution on the otolith, black sea bass, we're likely only going to get down to the resolution of comparing winter and summer seasons. But nonetheless, this is a really exciting project. Start seeing if the results that we found in the lab compare well to what may be the field metabolic rate of black sea bass. We can also start asking questions of seeing if black sea bass follows some sort of thermocline or essentially avoiding certain warm or cold temperatures. This summer, while I'm also out collecting black sea bass in Virginia and Delaware and taking their blood, I am now also taking more muscle, and I'm also now taking their otoliths to look at this, to send to Dr. Clive Truman to figure out their field metabolic rate and their thermal history.
All right. Well, it sounds like you have your hands full with all your different projects and collaborations you have going on. And I believe you also wanted to give a shout out to all the undergraduates and other people that have helped you with your research so far.
Yeah, especially for this second project that I'm working on, this energetics and fecundity of black sea bass throughout their range. I have basically needed the help of everyone. This includes a great undergraduate team that I've trained to help me with dissections, and also some of the finer scale physiology that we're doing in the lab with all of the tissues. So without them, none of this research would be possible. But I also have to thank all the other people that have been helping me. I've had a lot of amazing help from fishermen in all these regions that are really excited about the research, excited about helping me get black sea bass samples. A lot of state and government officials that have helped me with either connections or giving me lab space, universities as well, especially Virginia Institute of Marine Sciences and University of Massachusetts Dartmouth. Both of them have opened up their doors and let me completely destroy their wet labs while I'm there during dissections. And also all the people in different states that open up their couches to me. So got quite a network on the East Coast now that has essentially all made this project work.
Well, Emily, thank you for filling us all in on the work you're doing with black sea bass. But now the tough part of the interview is over, as we are down to the final five questions. And this is a group of five questions I ask each of the guests that come on the show. And we always start real simple with, what is your favorite fish?
Ooh, so it should be black sea bass, but it's actually the Pacific spiny lump sucker. So this is a tiny little like fish found in California. And anyone that's listening to this should immediately Google them and look and see their faces. They've got the most awkward faces in the world. They also, the real reason I fell in love with them is that their pelvic fins are actually modified suckers. And so these fish will suck onto kelp and rocks and whatnot along the California current. And it was the first time when I saw this fish, it was the first time I realized how cool the different types of morphology and uses of fish fins there are. So give my little guys a shout out.
All right. And I'm sure you've had quite a handful of interesting experiences traveling up and down the coast for your graduate project. But what is your favorite memory from your career so far?
So the first, which isn't really related to fisheries, but I was actually able to go on a research cruise in Antarctica this past winter. So I went down on a LTER cruise, which is long-term ecological research funded through NSF. And I was out on a ship for about 6 weeks. And I was going up and down the West Antarctic Peninsula, helping out with phytoplankton and zooplankton toes, as well as tagging whales and also IDing and doing census seeing of penguin colonies. So wasn't quite related to fisheries, but it was an incredible experience. Then related to my research, I got to say probably my favorite memory so far has just been working with all these different fishermen that have been helping me out. Everyone has been above and beyond gracious and helpful. And I also feel like after I leave these places that not only have I found some great people to work with, but I've also made some really good lifelong friends.
All right. And when you finish your PhD work, what is your dream job or dream location that you hope to end up in?
I've always been a jack of all trades. And so my dream job would allow me to flourish as a jack of all trades. So my PhD is kind of blending physiology, ecology, and fishery science. And my dream job would allow me to kind of combine all of those principles while also having a strong outreach component. I really love teaching and watching people learn new concepts and get really excited that they're starting to understand the science and be a part of this.
And if money was not an issue, what is one project that you would like to work on?
I really want to do a study looking at how storms affect fisheries. And so the obvious answer is you could look at amount of days that people aren't fishing based off of storms or the aftermath after storms. But a lot of times I've been out on boats where we go out maybe a day or two after a storm and fish will be there, but they don't bite at all. And there's a lot of different theories as to what's going on. You know, is it the turbulence? Is it a change in bottom currents? A lot of people think sometimes the massive freshwater runoff we get from all of the rivers and then also from the rain might affect distribution of food for the fish. And also especially as a lot of these fish on the East Coast spawn during the summer. And lately, the amount of large summer storms we've been getting have been increasing. So I really wanted to do a large-scale study looking at storm increase with climate change and how that's going to affect our fisheries, and both economically and also for the fishermen, and I guess ecologically as well.
And finally, if there was one point or one principle that you have programmed into everyone's head, what would it be?
Stay curious. Stay excited. You can learn from every mistake and every failure if you're just open to it. And just be nice to each other. Sometimes I feel a lot of good science is sort of stalled when people aren't very nice to each other. And so I think we just have to all help each other out as one big community.
That's very Ellen-esque. Be kind to one another, as she says at the end of every episode. So,
yep.
Well, Emily, thank you again for volunteering to come on the podcast today. It was a pleasure hearing about you and all the work you're doing on the East Coast with the black sea bass. If people want to find out more information or get a hold of you, what would be the best way to do that?
Yeah, so I've got a Twitter. My Twitter tag is fishtheologistm. It's F-I-S-H @iologit_em. And if you also want to send more science, you can email me SLESINGER@marine.rutgers.edu.
And if you would like to get a hold of me, you can find me on Twitter @FisheriesPod, on Facebook @facebook.com/FisheriesPodcast, or old-fashioned email feedback@thefisheriespodcast.com. I hope that you enjoyed this episode. You can download and subscribe to receive future episodes on your favorite listening app or stream it from Spotify or thefisheriespodcast.com. I am Nick Kramer, and thank you for listening to the 42nd episode of the Fisheries Podcast. Remember, stay curious, stay excited, and be nice to each other.